wife and I have shared with a number of people how God worked in us to bring about what would become New City Church. In order to be here today, my wife and I, frankly, had to go through a lot of pruning as God had to pry us away from some of our favorite sins, which turned out to be a very, very painful process, not one that I would like to go through again. My wife is a thinker and a planner. And one of the great things about, or one of the sad things about a strength is a strength can also become a person's weakness. And by the way, I have her permission to share this. In fact, this was her idea. So whatever I say comes this part from my wife. So as this thinker and planner, my wife used to be the world's greatest worrier. My wife can take a clear and rational thought and turn it into homelessness in about 5 steps. It's amazing how she could do this. We could be somewhere, say, the movie theater, and she can think, I think I might have left the curling iron on in the bathroom upstairs at home. Perfectly rational thought, uses extra electricity, that's a problem, and we don't want to waste money. However, if the curling iron was left on, that means the house could burn down. It doesn't get hot enough to ignite anything, but a house could burn down. But since her laptop is in the house, and since her laptop has all of her online passwords stored, that means she might not be able then to make the mortgage payment. And if she doesn't make the mortgage payment, that's going to lead to a foreclosure notice, which is terrible. Foreclosure notice would ruin our credit, and with bad credit, we wouldn't even be able to take the insurance money for a down payment on a new house. You see where this is going. Without a house to live in, we would have to move in with family. And we all know the tension and the problems that living with family could cause. And so we then have to move out of the family's home, and then we'd be homeless.
Logic, right? Makes sense. Well, it's a little funny to think of it
that way, but the reality is worry is a sin. Worry is telling God that you either do not think he can handle the situation or that he can't handle it to your satisfaction. In either case, worry is not a good thing. So when we come to a text like we have for today, it can be tempting to read it and fall back into old habits of worry that we all have. But instead, we need to follow John's example. The truth is, John had plenty to worry about, but he has a vision that removes his worries about both the present and the future, all because the slaughtered lamb reigns. Now think of what there is to worry about. I mean, think of this situation, right? A very wealthy, very proud, very arrogant man leads the most powerful nation on earth, right? His policies are at the same time both not fully known, but also the parts that are known are frankly really, really scary. There are those who are trying to think of ways to remove him from office so that another person can take his place in that office. There are natural disasters that are taking place all over the world. Many people lose their lives, and there's nothing anyone can do about it, whether it's earthquakes or tsunamis or hurricanes or floods or droughts, all kinds of problems. But then there's also a recession that has crippled the economy of the largest nation on earth, so much so that it actually affects trade globally. There are lots of people who hate Christians, thinking that Christians are people filled with hate themselves. They hate the world, and so they only have one desire, and that is to get rid of the Christians from the world altogether. And that's just the first century. Sounds a lot like the second century, and the third century, and the fourth century. John has several themes that continue to be demonstrated throughout Revelation, and this is perhaps the most important, and that is Jesus reigns. Jesus is Lord. That is our confession as Christians. That is the dominant theme in the book of Revelation. God is on his throne and nothing will remove him. In fact, John begins that theme in the very first chapter in verse 5. He says that Jesus is, present tense, Jesus is the ruler of kings on earth. Now, John makes no attempt to explain evil and suffering beyond asserting that Jesus is Lord even in the face of great evil in the world. He doesn't try to reconcile those two. This is why John, in his vision, sees the glassy sea before the throne. Remember, the sea represents the evil and the chaos of the world. From God's perspective, the chaos is as calm as a sea made of glass, right? As clear as crystal. There aren't any ripples in the sea of chaos before God's throne. That's from God's perspective. From John's perspective, however, the world is a mess. Right? The chaos of the world is raging against him and the seven churches. The Roman Empire is raging against John and the seven churches.
From his perspective, he knows that in the year 60, massive earthquakes had killed many, many people across the great empire of Rome. Widespread destruction.
In the year 64, Nero, the crazy Nero, had viciously attacked Christians, blaming them for a fire that took place in the city of Rome. In the year 79, Mount Vesuvius erupted and instantly killed more than 1,000 people. In the year 92, an empire-wide grain famine caused widespread loss of life. That's just 4 years before John wrote Revelation. And throughout John's entire lifetime, the empire had been in constant warfare. You can imagine the chaos and the troubles that people felt. In spite of the chaos, in spite of death and destruction wrought by these things, the visions of Revelation affirm that Jesus is Lord. In spite of appearances to the contrary, Jesus is Lord, which means he is in control of all things. Nothing happens outside of his control. Again, John makes no attempt to explain why bad things happen, only that they do happen, and yet Jesus is still the sovereign king who reigns over all, and he is never taken by surprise at the events of the chaotic sea of world history. John is assured of these things because, as he saw, the one who reigns forever and ever is a slaughtered lamb. The victorious lion of the tribe of Judah is a lamb that was slain. That's because Jesus transforms suffering. We're going to look at that in even greater detail next week. But Jesus transforms suffering. Suffering is not something that we endure aimlessly and without a purpose. For now, let's take a look at the first four seals. We saw last week that the Lamb has been given a scroll. The scroll is sealed with seven seals, and only the Lamb is worthy to open them. So we're in Revelation chapter 6. We're going to look at the first four of these seals. John writes, this is his vision. Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say, with a voice like thunder, "Come!" And I looked, and behold, a white horse. And its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him. And it came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come!" And out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and its rider had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures, saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine." When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by wild beasts of the earth. Now, before we take a closer look at these four seals, we need to recognize they are not chronological. John describes them in order because it's impossible to describe seven different things all at the same time. And so he puts them in an order. But you have to understand that what happens in the seals is, for the most part, simultaneous. All of these things are taking place. They describe human history in terms that, frankly, could apply to any era of human history. John sees the Lamb open the very first seal. He hears one of the four living creatures call forth a horse and its rider. The rider has a bow and is given a crown. This rider then goes forth conquering and to conquer. Now, when John sees that the rider was given a crown, this is what we call a divine passive. It's the passive voice. He was given. He doesn't use the active voice. This is in keeping with the Jewish tradition to use the passive voice when describing something God did. God is the one who gave the crown to this writer. This is a way to acknowledge God's role in something without naming him directly. Again, he could have said God gave him the crown. Instead, he follows the Jewish tradition and said a crown was given to him. Either way, God is the one who is in control of the situation. So how would John and the seven churches understand this first horse? Well, the first horse represents conquest. The Roman Empire grew one way, and that is through conquest, by attacking other nearby nations and conquering them, and then absorbing them into the empire. Nation after nation fell against the onslaught of a mighty Roman Empire. Its armies were unstoppable, except for a little nation called Parthia. Rome could not defeat Parthia. In 53 BC, Rome attempted to conquer Parthia, but Rome, the army, the great armies of Rome, were soundly defeated by the mounted Parthian archers, that is, archers on horseback. Fact is, the horses were too big, they were too fast, and the archers were too accurate to lose a battle with Romans walking toward them with spears. Rome tried again in the year 36 BC and was once again unable to conquer the mighty mounted Parthian archers. Now, technically, Rome won that battle, but only because the Parthian soldiers realized this was stupid. Let's just leave. It's kind of like the sixth grader who picks a fight with a senior. He might land one good punch, and the senior just looks at him and laughs and like, whatever, and he walks away. That's how Rome won that battle. Parthia just didn't feel like fighting, so they left. Still, Rome could not defeat them. And again, the year 62, just 34 years before John writes Revelation, Rome tried one more time to conquer Parthia and was again soundly defeated by the mounted Parthian archers. Fact is, there were limits to the power of Rome, and therefore, there were limits to Roman security. As strong as the empire was, it was not all-powerful. Rome couldn't conquer Parthia. It had lots of trouble with the Germanic tribes. In fact, the Germans would later come down about 300 years later and conquer the city of Rome itself. Security was merely an illusion in the Roman Empire. Fact is, there were constant threats to the security of Rome, and these military threats came from outside of the empire. The empire could no longer expand through conquest any further, but constantly had to fight simply to maintain its territories. So with this in mind, we have to remember what the temptation is facing the seven churches. They were in constant danger for their refusal to worship the emperor. Remember, Domitian is the emperor. He's the crazy eagle megalomaniac, right, who demands that he be worshipped as both Lord and God. It was required of everyone in the empire to worship him. They refused to do so. They refused to participate in the idolatry of the empire.
So the warning to them is clear. Offering ultimate allegiance to Rome
by worshiping the empire and the emperor is foolish, for neither can provide them the security they seek. John sees the Lamb open the second scroll, or the second seal. The second of the four living creatures calls forth another horse and a rider. He sees that this rider was permitted to take peace from the earth. Notice again the divine passive. He was permitted. Who permitted him? God permitted him to take peace from the earth. And notice the outcome of taking away peace. Men slay one another. Murder. Violence. Not violence from outside. This is violence, one citizen against the next. This rider isn't provoking war. This rider is provoking domestic hostility. Now keep in mind, Rome took great pride in its concept of Pax Romana. It's Latin, it just means Roman peace. They loved the Roman peace. Great orators would give eloquent speeches on their national holidays praising Rome and its peace and prosperity. This was the reason for Roman conquest. I mean, they simply wanted to bring their peace to the land of Parthia. Let those poor Parthians finally know what real peace and prosperity is. I mean, they just wanted Parthia to have real peace, right? I mean, sure, they would rape and loot and pillage on the way, but I mean, hey, you know, it's the price of peace, you know what I mean? You want to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggshells. See, Rome is very willing to spread peace at the end of the sword. This writer makes it clear, however, that the threat to Roman peace was a threat from within. The Romans themselves were the danger to Roman peace. So the first horseman represented the threat of conquest from foreign enemies. The second horseman shows that the threat is the Romans themselves. Okay, this blows my mind. Roman peace was so great and wonderful that in order to maintain it, whole cities and Roman governors and even Roman emperors were willing to murder their own people who dared worship a crucified man from a backwoods, hated corner of the empire. I mean, Roman peace was so great and so powerful and so majestic that a failure to take a pinch of incense and toss it onto a fire threatened to undo the whole empire. That's how great it was. So the seven churches are being challenged regarding their true allegiance. Trusting in the empire for everyday peace and safety was foolish. Just ask Antipas from Pergamum. Remember, he was the martyr that John names. Roman peace was simply not worthy of their allegiance. It was but a temporary vapor and illusion. John sees the Lamb open the third seal. Another of the four living creatures calls for another horse and its rider. This rider carries a pair of scales, the kind that are used in economic transactions. You would weigh out your gold and silver, make sure you weren't cheating anyone. Now, there's no divine passive in this with this rider, but there is a divine voice. A divine voice. Listen to what the voice declares. A quart of wheat for a denarius, 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. That makes sense, right? Well, a denarius was a unit of money. It was the typical amount a typical worker would earn in a typical day. It's not a minimum wage. It's sort of the average wage. Now, I looked it up. The national average wage index for the United States in 2015 was $48,098. That's an average, so some of you are like, oh, that's a lot of money. And some of you are like, who could live on that? The average full-time worker in America last year earned about $185 a day, 5 days a week. So working with today's numbers, that means a quart of wheat, think about that, a quart of wheat would cost about $185. That's expensive. In other words, you know, a quart of wheat is about the amount of food a man would need to survive. Not put on pounds, the amount of food a man would need to survive a day. $185 just to earn today's sustenance. That person would still need clothing. That person would still need shelter. There's no money left over for such luxuries. The divine voice calls out the price for barley. 3 quarts for a denarius. That's three times as much, right? Well, 3 quarts of barley was about the amount a typical small family needed in order to survive. But that family still needs clothing and shelter. Baby needs new shoes. No money left for such luxuries. See, the first seal represented conquest. The second one, violence. The third seal represents economic hardship. So I mentioned earlier, Revelation was written just 4 years after an empire-wide grain famine in which prices skyrocketed. The prices declared by this divine voice are between 8 and 16 times the normal price for both wheat and barley. But notice that the decree says that neither oil nor wine are to be harmed. Why is that? Who is buying olive oil? And who is buying wine? If your entire wage went to buy just enough wheat to survive that day. Well, in such a rich and prosperous empire like Rome, the only people who could afford such luxuries were the wealthy. The working man struggles to survive on wheat and barley, to buy new shoes for the little one and to pay that dentist bill. Meanwhile, the rich enjoys prosperity. Okay, wheat and barley are not signs. Having enough to eat wheat and barley eaten a day are not signs of prosperity. In fact, barley was looked down upon by the upper classes because that was like horse feed. That's what you give your horses. That's why it costs a third the price. You can buy 1 quart for a denarius of wheat or 3 quarts of barley horse feed for a denarius. So how would the seven churches understand this third seal? It's simple. No economic system can guarantee prosperity. No economic system can guarantee prosperity for all. Inequities will always exist. The rich will get richer, and the poor will still struggle to survive on a daily basis. Now, some Christians were struggling, as we've seen, financially because the trade guilds would limit their ability to earn a living because they would refuse to worship the god of the trade guild, or they would refuse to be good citizens and worship the emperor. And so they would struggle financially because they couldn't practice their trade. However, they cannot look to Rome for financial security. Therefore, granting their ultimate allegiance to Rome is foolish. John then sees the Lamb open the fourth seal. Another living creature calls forth yet another rider. But notice this rider is given a name, Death. And along with death comes Hades, or the grave. They were given, again, the divine passage, they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and famine and pestilence and wild beasts of the earth. Now, this seal acts really as a summary of the previous three. So, again, don't think of these as sequential. Try to understand them as the seven churches would understand them. The empire could not provide real protection against foreign enemies. The empire could not provide real protection against domestic enemies. The empire could not provide real protection against economic hardship. And the empire could not provide real protection against the greatest enemy of all. Death. ultimate final hope cannot be invested in a system of government or in a nation or in an empire, even one as vast and as powerful as Rome. Now, while Rome is limited in power, notice who is not. The fourth horseman and Hades, they're given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill. How much authority are they given? One fourth. That's a lot. That's a lot of death and destruction. But it's only one fourth. The one by whom they were given authority also restricted their authority. When the Lamb says one fourth, neither death nor Hades can go one fraction beyond that. It was one fourth and that's it. The seven churches are again reminded that while death and destruction are everywhere, death is powerless to do more than it is allowed to do. Death is on a leash. It may be a very long leash, but the divine hand that holds the leash can pull back at any moment. In fact, if the divine hand doesn't want to be pulled forward, it won't budge from where it is at God's side. In this vision, John is again borrowing from scriptures. We cannot possibly look at all of the allusions. But here he cites the book of Ezekiel very clearly. Hundreds of years prior to the revelation being written, the people of Israel had been taken into captivity. Not all of them were taken. Lots of them were left behind. The cultural elite, the intellectual elite were taken. Many of the people from royalty were taken. Those who were skilled craftsmen were taken because those people offered something to Babylon. And so they were taken to Babylon to cause Babylon to become more prosperous. It was the poor and the uneducated, those without skills, who are left behind to scratch an existence out of the rubble that used to be the nation of Israel. And during their time in Babylon, the prophet Ezekiel had a vision in which God spoke to him. This is from Ezekiel chapter 14. And the word of the Lord came to me, "Son of man, when a land sins against me by acting faithlessly, and I stretch out my hand against it and break its supply of bread and send famine upon it, and cut off from it man and beast, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver but their own lives by their righteousness, declares the Lord God." This word is for those who are in exile in Babylon. They know of Noah, who was faithful in the midst of great chaos in the world. The whole world's destroyed. They also know of Job, who was faithful in the midst of great chaos in the world. Remember, he lost his family and all of his livestock, all of his wealth, and then God gave it back. He was faithful in the midst of all of it. They also know of the man Daniel, who was alive when Ezekiel is writing this. They know that one of their own had been taken to Babylon, and as part of God's plan, he was raised up to a position of great influence in the Babylonian Empire. They knew Daniel, Daniel had this happen to him because of his righteousness in the midst of chaos and evil. See God's point. If even those three of the greatest heroes in Israel's history, if they were in the city of Jerusalem, they would not be enough to spare the city from destruction. They themselves would be able to walk out free, but the city would still be destroyed. God repeats his point in the rest of the text. First he says righteous men wouldn't spare the nation if he sends really what's economic hardship against them. He then says he wouldn't spare the nation against wild beasts. Remember, lions and bears and such. People were in danger at all times from these wild animals. He said the nation wouldn't be spared from a sword brought against them. And again, he says they wouldn't be spared on account of these three men if he sends pestilence against them. So not even the presence of these three righteous men would spare them from economic hardship, wild beasts, sword, and pestilence. Do those things sound familiar? Listen to how he summarizes this vision. This is in verse 20 on Ezekiel 14. "For thus says the Lord God, how much more when I send upon Jerusalem my four disastrous acts of judgment, sword, famine, wild beasts, and pestilence, to cut off from it man and beast. But behold, some survivors will be left in it, sons and daughters who will be brought out. And behold, when they come out to you, that is to you in Babylon, and you see their ways and their deeds, you will be consoled for the disaster that I have brought upon Jerusalem, for all that I have brought upon it. They will console you when you see their ways and their deeds, and you shall all know, you shall know that I have not done without cause all that I have done in it." Notice again the four acts of judgment: sword, famine, or economic hardship, wild beasts, and pestilence. The fourth rider comes to kill with sword and with famine and pestilence and wild beasts. Different order, but the same four acts of judgment. What we need to see here is the outcome of these things. These disastrous acts of judgment fall on all within the city, all within the nation, not just the wicked. There were righteous men and women in Jerusalem when the city was destroyed, and it was still destroyed. Not even the presence of Noah, Job, and Daniel would spare the city. You see what God's saying to the exiles about these acts of judgment? When some survivors would come from Jerusalem or come from the surrounding countryside and end up in Babylon, they will see their ways. That is, they will see the unrighteousness of the people who still live in the land. And then they will recognize, God, you are good and right in bringing this destruction upon us. That's what they're going to notice. That's what they're going to discover. The people are wicked. The people are evil. God is holy. Therefore, God is right in bringing these acts of judgment on the nation. A little scary. We have to keep in mind as we work our way through Revelation that it was written to seven very real churches that existed in the late first century. In Asia Minor, these seven churches were experiencing varying levels of hostility and persecution, both from the government, but also from their neighbors. John himself, the one who writes Revelation, is in prison on an island called Patmos, right off the coast of Asia Minor. These churches and John himself experience great suffering and pain because of their faith in Jesus, but also because this life is simply filled with pain and with suffering. Not all of their suffering came as a result of their faithfulness to Jesus. Some is just common to all of us. We all lose loved ones. We've all been affected by economic struggles, whether you've been unemployed or bankrupt. We all know someone who has been. Whether you've had a laptop die on Saturday afternoon before your sermon was finished, you know someone who had. And then whether you yourself then took your home PC and brought it into your office to try to work on it, and you have to spend about 4 hours getting it to work, you may not have experienced that, but you know someone who struggles. Car trouble, cell phones taking a bath, neighbors despising us because we're Christians, your favorite NBA team losing a close game, huge dentist bill, health insurance premiums rising yet again, tension with a family member, concerns and worries about the future. We all struggle. We all suffer in various ways. Here's John's message to the seven churches and to us. God is at work in the midst of great tragedy. We can be encouraged that suffering is not evidence of God's failure to reign. Suffering is actually evidence that God is reigning over all. Suffering is the proof that God is still in control of everything that happens in the world. So whatever the struggle and whatever the pain, God is at work in the midst of it. This is the reason for the divine passives in our text. God is not the one who has hurt you, but God is the one who could allow it to happen. It only happens because he allows these things to happen. Now, John makes no attempt to explain this. I wish he had. I struggle here. But John asserts this. God is absolutely sovereign in the midst of suffering, and God is absolutely good in the midst of suffering. You know, if you ever read a book or go to a conference on how to grow a church, that's not a message they want you to preach. You're not going to hear the guys asking for your money on TV telling you about the suffering that comes part and parcel with being a follower of Jesus. This is why John alludes to the Ezekiel text. As the people of God experienced great pain and suffering, with many of them being killed, many of them being taken into captivity, God tells them that one day they will see the full reason for the trouble, and they will praise God for his goodness in the midst of it. His goodness is in the midst of suffering, and it is this. This is his goodness in the midst of suffering. It is never as bad as it could be, and his plan for using that suffering is a good plan.
One day we will see how it all works out. One day we're going to look at all of human history and say,
oh, that's why those things happen. Now I understand. God, you are amazing. But that's one day. We're on this
side of the suffering. One day when we're on the other side and we look back, that's when it will make sense. That's why
John's writing this vision for us, so that we can see it from God's perspective. And from God's perspective, what does the
chaotic sea of the world look like? It's calm as glass, like crystal.
Until then, we suffer and we hurt and we struggle. But even as we hurt and even as we struggle and even as we suffer, we must be able to say no worries. That must be our motto. And I don't mean it in like a Hakuna Matata sort of way. Right? You remember the cartoon, the warthog singing Hakuna Matata, no worries? He had no worries because he just
didn't care what happened. That's not what I mean when I say no worries.
I mean, we have no reason to worry because of what John has seen in this vision. I told you back in chapter 4 that the vision of God in chapter 4 was essential for understanding everything else in the book of Revelation. And what did John see in chapter 4? He saw God seated at his throne, absolutely sovereign, absolutely doing what he is pleased to do with no one to stop him
and no one to force his hand. You have to understand God's sovereignty in order to understand anything else in the book of Revelation.
John sees God on his throne ruling in absolute sovereignty, and because he is sovereign, we can know that God is guiding and directing human history to its intended purpose.
And one day we will understand that purpose, and we will agree with God that he was both good and right
in allowing that suffering to happen. We ought to have no worries, not
because our lives are trouble-free. They're not. We ought to have no worries, not because of an I don't care attitude. We ought to live with no worries because we can trust God
in the midst of hard times. Because even in the midst of hard times, he is still on his throne. It's not like God gets up and, you know, pardon the expression, is using the restroom when he comes back and discovers all the problems, like, oh, let me fix this. It's that God is on the throne the entire time the hard times come. John is given this vision to encourage these seven churches, to remind them that the world, as it is currently, is not our home. Even today we observe as the
first Sunday of Advent, we look forward to the return of our Prince of Peace, who will make this world as
it should be, and the world as it should be is our home and will be our home forever. Problem is, some of us live as though this world is all there is, and so they give into great despair. Sometimes we live with no thought for the future. It's easy to fall into the trap of worry when we fail to take into account that God is working on a different time scale than we are. See, God will end all suffering. He will end all suffering. Did you hear that? God will end all suffering when he determines the time is right. But it will end. There's guarantee of it. It will one day come to an end. But in his time, not in ours. John encourages the seven churches to remain faithful to Jesus during struggle and pain, to not give in to the temptation, to find an easy way out of the struggle. Because as the four horsemen show, Rome offers no relief from pain or from suffering. We must therefore praise God in whatever our circumstances are, whatever circumstances we find ourselves in, because he is and always will be Lord of all. In the midst of great struggle and pain, my wife learned how to pray. Because she and I discovered there is only one who is trustworthy in the midst of our pain. And frankly, if you're going to suffer, he's the one you ought to be trusting in. Because he's the only one who can end it. So we must be people of prayer, just as our Lord taught us. What did he teach us? How did he teach us to pray? Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. From God's perspective, the chaotic sea of suffering of the world is as calm as a glassy sea. One day our hope is that he's going to bring that sea down here. In fact, the end of Revelation tells us that one day when he returns, the sea will be no more. There will be no more pain and suffering. There is an end to suffering. There's only one who can fix what is wrong in this world. There's only one who can bring about true and everlasting peace. There is only one who is worthy of our allegiance, and he is not Rome. His name is Jesus, and he is the Lord of all.